Yeah, thanks a lot. Thank you for inviting me to speak at Content again. Indeed, nuclear weapons is a topic that is not going away so fast, or not as fast as we would want to. But in spite of the fact that we're talking about the most powerful weapons that have ever been invented, I suppose they are not very much near the public imagination or are not at the top of people's worries. And indeed, we see that the previous talk garnered slightly more attention than this one, given that, of course, it was a local topic, it was something that really touches people directly where they live, whereas nuclear weapons can be a little abstract, can be far away, and can certainly be something that hasn't been used in many decades, and or at least seemingly hasn't been used in many decades. And so we tend to have more pressing worries. Nevertheless, I think nuclear weapons are, of course, one of the few things that are at least a risk to human life as such. So if we mess up with nuclear weapons, then basically extinction of the human race is on the cards. And in that sense, it's only comparable to, let's say, pandemics, climate change, and maybe the latest craze is AI and the way that AI is going to take over the planet. So, of course, AI can also interlink with nuclear weapons, but that's maybe for another day. Certainly, in the last years, we've had a number of reminders that nuclear weapons are still around, that nuclear weapons are still a thing. Even though I would say the reminders were maybe fleeting or didn't really captivate the public in a way that nuclear weapons did maybe during the Cold War in the 1980s. And so after the end of the Cold War, I think many moved on and thought, well, nuclear weapons are probably not a danger anymore. And maybe it's just me, because I work on the topic, but I was under the impression that in the last years there's been a cascade of reminders of nuclear weapons still being there, still being a danger, starting with basically the election of Donald Trump to the US presidency, but then also North Korea testing nuclear weapons quite regularly. Then there was, of course, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia in 2022, which came with very regular and also escalating nuclear threats on the side of the Russian president. And so basically we are very often reminded that nuclear weapons are still around and that there are not incredibly rational actors who are in charge of nuclear weapons command and control. So before I continue, maybe just a few words on ICAN as a campaign. ICAN is the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. This is an old graph. Actually, we have more than 600 partners by now, so you see it's a growing campaign. Just a few years ago, it was significantly less. And here in Germany, we have an office which we founded a bit more than 10 years ago. And here's a picture of us in front of the Brandenburg Gate back then. And maybe I should say a few words about what the role is that ICAN is playing in the nuclear weapons debate, and what countries and people who are worried about nuclear weapons can do themselves. The situation is that indeed we do still have nuclear weapons around. They're a very risky thing to have, given that they're weapons of mass destruction. If anything goes wrong, then of course many million people will die in the best of cases, but we'll talk about the worst case scenarios later on. And the question is, basically, in this scenario, what can, if we have 9 nuclear armed states who for themselves have decided that they want to have weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons for their security, what can the rest of the international community, what can the silent majority of countries that do not have nuclear weapons do in order to protect their interests, protect their national security, make sure that they don't become the victims of nuclear fallout, of an accident, miscalculation, or an all-out nuclear war? And so the basically all other countries face two options now. One is either they fall for the advertisement. So if the most powerful countries on Earth think they need nuclear weapons for their security, surely there's value in having nuclear weapons. They're a status symbol, and therefore other countries should then emulate them and also acquire nuclear weapons for themselves. Or the alternative to that would be to try and accelerate the push to nuclear disarmament. And in fact, all nuclear armed states have committed to nuclear disarmament, so it's really a problem of procrastination, of them not being held to their promises. But nevertheless, even though we have seen now decades of nuclear weapons basically making empty, nuclear weapon states making empty promises and trying to show that they will better themselves and that they will quit having nuclear weapons, we see that there is very little progress in that regard. The numbers are coming down. From 80,000 nuclear weapons, we are now down to 12,000 nuclear weapons. But of course, that would still allow us to incinerate the world many times over. So that is not so much disarmament, but rather efficiency considerations, because if you can get the job done with 12,000 nuclear weapons, then you'd be a bit of a messy to still keep 80,000 around. But nevertheless, even though the nuclear armed states have made it very clear, not just with their statements, but also with their policies, with where their money is flowing into investments, modernization into nuclear weapons, nevertheless, the rest of the world has not chosen the path of also acquiring nuclear weapons for themselves, luckily, but rather has decided to double down on nuclear disarmament. And, well, if it's not really within your own power to force nuclear armed states to disarm, the only thing you can really do from the outside as a third country is to change international law in order to increase the pressure on nuclear armed states to disarm. And this they did by negotiating a new treaty. And this is where ICAN comes in, basically, because, of course, for many decades, countries were extremely worried about the presence of nuclear arms around the planet, and they tried to get progress towards disarmament. But there was this nuclear non-proliferation treaty, which was basically the legal framework within which these negotiations happened. And that is a very discriminatory treaty because it gives some states the right to have nuclear weapons, while it's forbidden for everybody else. But in turn, there's the commitment to disarm, right? And then there's all of these very complicated, lengthy legal conferences about, you know, all the steps that they have to take and so on. And it was becoming very obvious that this isn't happening. And therefore, we needed to sort of concentrate this very complex diplomatic arena to a slightly more pointed question, which is whether nuclear weapons should be legal or illegal. The question is actually fairly simple to answer, given that under international humanitarian law, if you have a weapon of mass destruction that doesn't differentiate between civilians and combatants, if you have a weapon that whose effects are not limited in time but whose effects unfold over generations, if you have a weapon that makes absolutely disproportionate effects on the environment and the seas and so on, that is just a very clear-cut case of a weapon that will not be able to be used in conformity with international humanitarian law. And international humanitarian law is something that all states have pledged to respect. So it is very difficult to see how they could be used. But again, for these 9 nuclear armed states, obviously this is not clear enough, and so we needed to have a more specific treaty that codifies the prohibition of nuclear weapons, much like we do with biological weapons, with chemical weapons. And, well, let's say a silent majority of states was long on board with that idea. But for states, it's much like for the rest of us. Nuclear weapons are not the first thing we think of when we get up in the morning. And therefore, it was just a bit difficulty of, you know, meeting up and having putting on the agenda that, you know, on this particular day at the United Nations in New York, we shall discuss nuclear weapons and we shall agree to prohibit them. So ICANN came a bit in as an agenda setter, as a logistical matchmaker. We went around with lists through the corridors of the UN, hitting up states and making sure that they give us a yes or a no for an answer. And then we told all the other states how many have already said yes. And then when they started to feel like, well, actually, this sounds like we are in a crushing majority, maybe it's time to then indeed go ahead and codify the fact that we all agree that nuclear weapons are bad. That sounds a bit simplistic, but you know that's kind of the gist of it. Over the years, with repeated statements by these committed states to nuclear disarmament, who will then make more statements in order to show each other, encourage each other that yes, indeed, they are in the majority and they are willing to take the leap forward. That took a few years to try and garner the courage for that, and that's maybe a bit longer than we initially anticipated as ICANN, but the reason for this is also pretty clear. If you're trying to put negotiations on the agenda against specifically the interests of the most powerful countries on Earth, then yes, you do have some opposition, you do have some levers that they can pull in order to try and frustrate progress and to make sure that some states are pressured not to join this process and so on. And that's exactly what we saw. And so now we have a bit of a situation where the nuclear armed states are, of course, rather offended that the rest of the world told them that they consider their weapons to be illegitimate, illegal, stigmatized. And now we're having to kind of bridge that divide between those that consider nuclear weapons illegal and those that would rather stick to them. So sorry, I have to walk around a little bit here for the presentation, but it's also more of an illustrative nature, so not all that important. This is a bit to show the process of the United Nations. Basically, you see a bit of a black hole there, which is a metaphor for the many documents and unheeded statements that over decades have constituted the bulk of nuclear disarmament diplomacy. And here we have a ray of sunlight, basically the ready treaty on the day of adoption in 2017, signed here by many campaigners and committed diplomats who were rather proud of having made history that day. And now, of course, the difficult work begins, because now we've codified that nuclear weapons are illegal. It's a bit like codifying in national law that that murder is illegal, right? You can't just go around killing people, but that doesn't mean that it stops happening right away. No? And now in international law, we codified that you can't have weapons of mass destruction, you can't have nuclear weapons. But lo and behold, the nuclear armed states are still there, they still have their nuclear weapons, they don't recognize this treaty as international customary law, of course they don't, given that they object to it. Nevertheless, it was a historic moment to finally have a vast majority of countries empowered to codify the ban of nuclear weapons. And it was actually also one of the first times that the Global South, if you can say so, came together as a and empowered each other to challenge the hegemony of the nuclear armed states. And also that year, ICANN then received the Nobel Peace Prize in recognition of our efforts to bring about this treaty. And of course, that also helped give a lot of more attention to the fact that the treaty had been adopted, to the underlying humanitarian narrative of reasons why nuclear weapons are unacceptable and must be prohibited and eliminated as fast as possible. And it also helped us, as ICANN, to campaign for adhesion to the treaty. Because the treaty, at the end of the day, is not a goal in itself, but is a tool that we can use in order to first legally, then politically, morally, and economically corner nuclear weapons, right? And that process is now underway. So the first step is, of course, to make sure that as many states as possible sign and ratify this treaty. It then entered into force in due course. Then we have to use this treaty politically in order to pressure nuclear armed states into making concessions, into speeding up their nuclear disarmament work, in convincing domestically political parties within nuclear armed states to stop wasting money on weapons that can never be used, finding new allies in these states, such as the military, which is usually quite keen to respect international humanitarian law and make sure that they don't go against commitments that they have made with other countries. And then, of course, also economically, which is maybe one of the strongest vectors, given that at the end of the day, financing decisions are the way in which actual priorities manifest themselves in our societies, right? So if something doesn't get any money allocated to it, then it's not going to happen. That, at the end of the day, is a very clear mechanism. And so, of course, most of the funding for nuclear weapons is public funding. So yes, we can pressure states to try and waste less public resources on this stuff. But there are, of course, the contractors, the companies that are producing components of nuclear weapons, that are producing delivery vehicles, the missiles, the bombers, the submarines, and so on. And they are, of course, also dependent on private financing, specifically from banks and investors. And banks generally are active transnationally, so they do take international law as a strong cue as to what is acceptable for their investment practices and what is not. And therefore, we have been actually very successful in trying to get specifically big banks, transnational banks, to actively divest from nuclear weapons, getting pension funds, getting insurance funds, and so on, to really specifically pull out the money from any investments that risk having money be funneled into delivery vehicles or maintenance or other aspects of the nuclear weapons enterprise. So really narrowing the space in which nuclear weapons can exist. Now, of course, that too is a bit of a long-term project, but usually, you know, I would think that it takes about one generation for such a massive political reframing and moral reframing to really take root. I don't think that people will notice within 2 or 3 years that this treaty has entered into force. But you know, the next generation of politicians, the next generation of journalists, the next generation of academics who opine on these kinds of topics, they will grow up in just being aware of the fact that nuclear weapons are indeed banned by a crushing majority of states on Earth. And that will, of course, change their perception of the political value of nuclear weapons. And the goal is indeed to remove basically nuclear weapons as a status symbol and really stigmatize them for what they are, for as tools of mass murder, as weapons that are there only and specifically designed to kill as many civilians as possible by wiping out entire cities. Now, the most recent thing that or development that really brought nuclear weapons to our attention was surely the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And that really has manifold different effects, I'd say, on the discourse relating to nuclear weapons. On the one hand, I like to point to international law as a bit of a moral compass, given that it really allows us to kind of say, okay, under international law, it's absolutely legitimate to send weapons to Ukraine in order to help them defend themselves. Under the United Nations Charter, any member state of the United Nations has the right, and some would say a responsibility, to support countries that have been invaded by another state. So that's very clear under international law. And also, with regard to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, it's very clear that nuclear weapons are illegal, and therefore, if you're going to support Ukraine, you're going to have to do it with conventional weapons. But as these things go, so you know, the kind of the shock value of a war on the European continent, also of it being quite close to the European Union, Western Europe, and so on, it's going to unsettle people. And indeed, this is what we see in the short term. So there's various extreme reactions, if I can caricature them a little bit. One is saying, oh, well, this would all not have happened had Ukraine held on to the nuclear weapons that they had. And for this, we should note that until 1994, nuclear weapons were indeed present in Ukraine. They had sort of been left there by the Soviet Union, and Ukraine then kind of seceded from the Soviet Union. And then, of course, there were still some nuclear weapons within Ukraine, given that not everything had been moved the same day that they seceded. And then there was this entire negotiation about how to get them back, repatriate them to Russia as the successor state of the Soviet Union. And the thinking goes, well, Ukraine should have just kept them, and then they would have been fine. But this argument is really quite short-sighted, given that Ukraine at no point in time had control of those weapons, think launch codes, think technology required to indeed have the entire command and control structure. And secondly, if we remember how the war in Ukraine started in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea, it is rather questionable at what point do you mass murder the population of Moscow after some, you know, disguised Russian military operatives have appeared in the peninsula of Crimea. Like, it's just, you know, at what point do you go and you kill a bunch of millions of civilians, risking to set off World War III and maybe the extinction of the human race? So that's a bit the credibility issue that nuclear deterrence always suffers from, and I'd like to speak about that in a moment in more depth. The other extreme is to say, oh, look, well, we shouldn't be sending any support to Ukraine because we're just going to be prolonging the war, we're going to prolong the suffering. Ukraine should just, I don't know, surrender and or find some sort of accommodation with the Russians, and this is going to be the most peaceful solution for us all. And that, of course, is also a position that is going to detract a little bit from the solution. So this is a bit of a difficult moment for, let's say, the broader campaign of actors and people trying to eliminate nuclear weapons. Given that, as a broad church campaign, what you need to do is you need to focus on a specific issue. You have, like, the easiest way to have a broad coalition in favor or against one in thing or another is to really focus, be a single issue campaign, basically, so as to be able to really mobilize a majority, whether you agree with them or not, on other topics, on topics such as invasions in Ukraine, or even, you know, whether democracy is something that we should uphold, or when we're talking about cooperating with states on the international level, of course, if you want to get nuclear disarmament done, you have to cooperate with a lot of countries that are not democracies, that do not have a good human rights record. And domestically, the same appears, the same problem holds. Domestically, within political systems, of course, we have a lot of support from people on the center-left of the political spectrum, but not just that. We also have a lot of support from the Vatican, which is a huge supporter of our work, and so political actors that maybe put Christianity at the heart of their work can also, based on that, support nuclear disarmament. Not in Germany, unfortunately, but you know, elsewhere it does happen. And so you have to kind of have a broad coalition, and that becomes a little bit difficult for all of the member partners of ICANN who are pacifist organizations, and with also the political parties that so far have supported Germany, for example, signing the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, but that now maybe have a stronger focus on helping out Ukraine. And so there's even some who will then reduce the enthusiasm with which they try to convince the United States of America to remove their nuclear weapons from German territory. And then there's also the, some unfortunate examples for people who start a debate on how Europe should have their own nuclear deterrent and the European Union should, you know, start to put money together in order to develop our own weapons of mass destruction. So these kinds of things then kind of happen, and then you can see a bit of debate that is going a bit off the rails. I mean, it's honestly not a very substantive debate. If you think about it for a few minutes, then you realize very quickly that it doesn't make sense for 27 European leaders and the European Council to try and decide whether to mass murder anyone. But nevertheless, these debates then sort of come up and muddy the picture, and it becomes a lot more difficult to do the systematic political work of trying to reduce the incidence and the role of nuclear weapons in our security doctrines and convince people to withdraw them from European territories. So I think the bigger picture, to kind of zoom out a little bit, is that, of course, nuclear disarmament is going to be a step to global peace, but both of these are a bit of a long shot, and I think that nuclear disarmament is still a little bit easier to achieve than global peace everywhere and forever. But of course, it's important when we kind of have these very big challenges in front of us to not be fooled by, you know, cynical, oh, it's never going to happen, or by this tendency to see things either in a black or a white fashion. No? Because of course, nuclear disarmament is not something that's happening or is not happening, but it's a process. And if we now have 12,000 nuclear weapons, yeah, that's a lot better than having 80,000 nuclear weapons. Conversely, if we can convince nuclear armed states to reduce the funding for their nuclear weapons, short of getting rid of them entirely, then of course that's going to get us a lot closer to global zero than if we don't engage with them at all, right? So nuclear disarmament is a process. It's really not just about the numbers, it's also about the role that we give to nuclear weapons in our security doctrines. It's about the way that we speak about them, whether we speak about them as something that is helping our security situation or that is, in fact, putting our lives at risk. And therefore, it's very important to keep on doing this work and try and focus on that, rather than having all of these other difficulties around the debate of nuclear weapons, which risks bringing elements into the debate which are not very much covered by the facts. But there was also, and this is also in the context of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, quite a number of positive developments. Because maybe you remember that in 2022 in particular, in the first half year of the war, Putin was really escalating his nuclear threats. And there was a lot of saber rattling, and they were always, if anybody supports Ukraine, then we will use nuclear weapons and so on and so forth. So that was really a crescendo and something that had people very worried. And then the G20 came together to condemn the nuclear threats, and they did it in a way that really echoed the language from the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which for us was a big breakthrough, given that in the G20 you have many countries that think that the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons was a bad idea because they also like their own nuclear weapons. And so that also shows you, well, it's a little bit difficult to condemn nuclear threats if you yourself also have nuclear weapons and if you yourself also enact a policy of nuclear deterrence. And this is where we have a bit, I'll go to a slide which is maybe a little bit more detailed, because on nuclear deterrence, this is really the fundamental issue that is at the heart of the problem of nuclear disarmament, given that instinctively many people believe in nuclear deterrence. It's just, you know, if you have a bigger stick, and this is something that diplomats actually told me, if you have a bigger stick on the school ground floor, on the court of the school, then people will respect you. And this is something that apparently makes intuitive sense to people, and indeed, I mean, having discussed this issue in many bars over many years, I can attest to that. But of course, nuclear deterrence does mean that you have to credibly threaten adversaries that you will wipe out millions of their civilian population, and that you will be able to do so within just a few minutes of being attacked. Given that if you don't do it within just a few minutes, you're going to be losing your own nuclear weapons, so you have to be ready to strike any opponent 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and it can't take you more than just a few minutes to take the decision. This means that nuclear deterrence is in itself the same sort of threat that, of course, the Russian president was making more explicitly in the context of the Ukraine war. And so it's a bit difficult to criticize those threats if you yourself are constantly threatening the other nuclear armed states with mass murder. And of course, nuclear deterrence is also a circular logic, given that, you can claim that nuclear deterrence is what kept the peace over the last 79 years. But actually, there was many proxy wars. Actually, there was a number of cases where nuclear deterrence completely failed. So, for example, in the 1950s in Korea, China went into the Korean War, even though they didn't have nuclear weapons yet, and even though the United States had specifically warned them not to. Or Argentina attacked the Falkland Islands of the United Kingdom, even though one had nuclear weapons and the other didn't. Israel was attacked, even though they already had nuclear weapons many times. And then, of course, there's also all the proxy wars between the great powers. So claiming that there was no great power conflict during the Cold War is also really untenable with regard to the historical record. And therefore, we really don't have a lot of data, of course, to say that that nuclear deterrence is a perfect system that is guaranteed to keep nuclear war from happening. What we really have is we have 79 years of experience, which is, of course, a very short amount of time. It's a blip in the millennia of history of human armed conflict. And we have these 79 years in which we were lucky enough for nuclear weapons not to be used. But, I mean, one of the reasons why nuclear deterrence is such a problematic concept is that, of course, for it to work, it has to work 100% of the time. Even a small error rate of 1% means that within 100 years, the world will go kaboom. So we're now closing in on the 100 years. There's been many, many, many instances of miscalculations, of accidents, of nuclear weapons being accidentally dropped from planes, of planes crashing with nuclear weapons on board, of nuclear weapons getting lost in the sea, of balloons, of crows, of the moon coming over the horizon, all being misinterpreted as the launch of nuclear missiles by an enemy, of test tapes being run without anybody noticing so that you had a very credible scenario of an all-out Russian attack on your hands. And all of these things, of course, inspire panic until it's over. And there's many, many mishaps of this sort that we don't know, given that when you accidentally almost blew up the planet, it's not like you're going to tell everyone. So all of the cases that we know of are actually from the US and the UK, given that all of the other nuclear armed states have completely kept secret their undoubtedly numerous nuclear mishaps. And therefore, as long as we have 12,000 nuclear weapons lying around, being, you know, maintained, moved, modernized, and so on, the risk of an accident or of a willful use of nuclear weapons is quite simply not zero. And if it's not zero, then mathematically, eventually, it will happen. So this is something that we need to bear in mind, something that we need to also prepare for. And that brings us back to the initial consideration of this ridiculous situation where we have just a small handful of countries, 9 nuclear-armed states, holding the rest of the world hostage, given that, of course, the effects of any nuclear detonation will by nature be cross-border and will be felt globally. In fact, of course, over the decades, there have been modeling of what would precisely happen with a number of nuclear detonations. And even in a very small-scale scenario, where just India and Pakistan would exchange about 15 nuclear weapons each, so small weapons because they don't have particularly large ones, and only 50, which in the scale of 12,000 nuclear weapons worldwide is of course a rather small number. Even this limited nuclear exchange in two countries that we haven't even mentioned so far in the greater scheme of nuclear armed conflict would make so much smoke and soot go up into the outer layers of the atmosphere, into the stratosphere where it cannot be rained out by the clouds, that basically we'd have a roughly 10-year period of what's called nuclear winter, which would decrease the amount of sunlight by 15-20% and would basically lead to the starvation of 1, maybe 2 billion people. So here, the 300, 400 million people who will be killed by the nuclear weapons themselves are the small part of the picture, given that the vast majority of fatalities will occur from basically starvation on the other side of the planet in countries that have absolutely nothing to do with the entire decision-making that goes into nuclear weapons. So the urgency here is really to find a way how this silent majority of states that would suffer the consequences of nuclear weapons can try and get this urgency across with a small number of nuclear-armed states who still haven't gotten the memo and who basically refuse to engage with the very broad, very substantive, very well-researched arguments that really pull the carpet underneath the whole concept of nuclear deterrence, that show how much worse than imagined the humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons are, and that also, I would say, remove any credibility that's left to the argument that nuclear deterrence might be conducive to national security, even of nuclear armed countries, or then of, you know, third countries that get extended deterrence like Germany or much of Europe. Given that, of course, it's not very credible to say, oh, look, I'm going to nuke millions of your civilians if you do this or you do that. So nuclear blackmail is not really a successful strategy in international relations. But also it's not very credible that you're going to have New York be bombed in exchange just because one of your European allies has been attacked. So even before Trump became president of the United States, it was plenty obvious to everybody that the United States was not going to involve themselves in a nuclear exchange just to protect, you know, Vilnius or far-flung countries in NATO member states. But the fact that much of Europe, therefore, does not have a credible nuclear deterrent on its side obviously hasn't led to an invasion by Russia either, or by any other state for that matter, given that nuclear deterrence is pretty much optional. Most countries on Earth do not have any sort of nuclear deterrent. This doesn't mean that they get pushed around. It doesn't mean that they get invaded. It just means that they took the responsible choice of not having nuclear weapons lie around, and that they are somewhat safer because they are at least not a target of nuclear weapons themselves. Now, as I mentioned, the prohibition of nuclear weapons is done. That's the first step. And now here we have a bit of a visualization of the geographic distribution of nuclear armed states and those that support nuclear weapons and the rest. And this is the states that have adopted the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. Voila. But this is basically now the long, difficult work of trying to convince the nuclear armed states to further reduce their numbers and eventually maybe get to global zero. I think I've talked for long enough, and if there's any questions, comments, if you have other ideas or are provoked by anything that I said, please go for it. I see one already here in the front.
First, thanks a lot for your work. And I guess it's quite meaningful and very important, and it's a bit pity that your organization is not that well known, obviously. You talked a lot about getting nuclear weapons out of Germany, out of Europe, etc. do you have in mind a kind of balance between democracies and dictators who own nuclear weapons? I just started to imagine a world where only Russia, China, North Korea, and maybe Iran, etc., have nuclear weapons, and all the other countries got them out, and then we have no tool of pressure, and they could do whatever they want, I guess. Small countries are maybe not their main enemies, like Russia, who wants to beat the US and Europe, I guess. What about keeping the balance? Do you have that in mind?
Thanks for this question. By the way, you can also ask questions in German, of course, if you prefer. I just thought it was more inclusive to do the talk in English, but German works fine too. No, of course, this is indeed a common issue that comes up that, look, it's going to be easier for an international, for a civil society organization like ours to influence democratic countries. In Russia, our work would be forbidden, our operatives would be in jail. It's not going to be that easy. But, first of all, I mean, the idea of nuclear disarmament is not that, you know, all democratic Western countries disarm and then we see what happens. I think it's more of a gradual movement. So first, of course, yes, the European countries, they could just get rid of nuclear weapons and nobody would notice, right? UK, France, if they didn't, they could get rid of their nuclear weapons and not tell anybody and nothing would change, or they could tell everyone and it's not like, you know, people would start invading France or the UK. And the same for the extended nuclear deterrence for all the rest of Europe. That is kind of a bit of an easier choice. When it comes to Russia and the United States, yes, they've always moved in tandem. They are both responsible for 90% of the nuclear stockpile worldwide. So, in a way, they do have to talk to each other and try and reduce their numbers. At the same time, this shouldn't be overdone. I mean, look, if you have 300 nuclear weapons, that's going to be plenty to mess up Russia, you know? So you don't have to have 6,000 nuclear weapons just to have the same number as your enemy. That's just not necessary. And you also don't want to give your opponent a veto over your own nuclear policy. So if the United States determines for itself that it should have 500 nuclear weapons and not 5,000, then they shouldn't not do it just because, you know, it's going to, on paper, make it look like Russia has more. I mean, that's going to be impressive for people like Trump, but, you know, on the policy-making level, that it shouldn't work like that. Another argument is that, of course, even in dictatorships, they are quite keen to respect international law. International law is not just for democracies. Also, Russia, before they invaded and so on, they were usually, I mean, it was a bit devious, but they nevertheless try to, you know, portray what they do to be in line with international law. Lately, certainly less, but generally speaking, international law is for everybody. It's not just for democracies. Even though civil societies campaigns can, of course, garner more support in democracies. But then, if we can't be present in China and in Russia and North Korea, that's just going to increase the pressure on the more classic actors of international relations, which are, you know, the International Committee of the Red Cross, or the foreign ministries of UN member countries, who will then simply have to themselves advance the arguments in front of the other states as to why they need to reduce their nuclear stockpiles and as to why they should adhere to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So it's too easy to say, oh, we are democracies, we are going to fall for, you know, the siren song of civil society telling us to do the right thing, but then we're going to be naked and we're going to be invaded by dictators. I mean, again, you know, dictatorship, also these dictators are not going to make themselves particularly popular by nuking their way into other countries and then taking over the barren, irradiated lands that reside from that. And honestly, I wouldn't like to, but if they tried, you can sort of imagine what happens also in a dictator, right? They're not in full control of their societies. If they go killing dozens of millions of innocent civilians, let's say that the Russian population wouldn't have much to lose at that point. So it's unlikely to end well for anybody. So quite simply, I don't think it works like this. But yeah, of course, it's going to be easier and faster to have the political debate move in democratic countries. At the same time, dictatorships too can are responsive to, let's say, substantive arguments and to empirical research. It just happens on other channels. And the argument for having nuclear weapons is really quite short-sighted and is easily debunked.
I have a couple of questions, if that's fine. First, so obviously we talk a lot about superpowers, but also you just talked about dictators, for example. And I feel, I'm asking your opinion: has like nuclear deterrence, has it been an effective method for Kim Jong-un, for example? Mm-hmm. And how would you prevent people in the future, dictators in the future, from the fear of due to the fear of regime change, having nuclear weapons?
Yeah, no, I mean that's actually narrowing in on an aspect of the previous question which I left untouched. Look, I mean, at the end of the day, nuclear weapons are useful only for small countries. Given that they are kind of the great equalizer, right? I mean, North Korea has nothing in terms of an effective military that could compete with South Korea. They have less population, they have less technology, they have less money to go around. So of course, if they want to be sure that they don't get invaded, nuclear deterrence is probably going to work a little bit better than their outdated military equipment. And so this is the risk that we face, right? That nuclear weapons are so achievable as a technology. I mean, it's 1940s technology, right? Any small country that devotes its resources to acquiring a nuclear weapon has the capability of doing so. So it's just a matter of time until you get a dictator who is mad enough not only to develop nuclear weapons, but also to use them, right? So this is the risk that we have. For as long as nuclear weapons are around, for as long as they are not something that is, you know, completely taboo and completely prohibited for everybody, you do have the risk that another North Korea emerges, or that the next dictator in North Korea, or the current one, becomes even crazier in a way and ends up even using nuclear weapons for one reason or the other. So this is the risk that, of course, we sort of accept by not banning nuclear weapons entirely. And this is, I think, one of the strong arguments also for the more powerful countries that have nuclear weapons to indeed make sure that nuclear materials are all kept safe and that nuclear weapons are at nobody's reach, not for the big countries, not for the small countries. But for as long as that doesn't happen, again, it's 1940s technology. If North Korea can have nuclear weapons, anybody can have nuclear weapons.
So okay, thank you. So the other question was, I remember I once saw a film, and in this film there was the former foreign minister of foreign secretary of the U.S., Colin Powell, who said he learned one thing about nuclear weapons, which is that they can never be used. Do you think there's a reasonable case in the future where anyone would use them in the near future?
That's the whole problem with the future, that you can't, foresee it. And Colin Powell says they cannot be used. But this is not the same as saying they will not be used, right? There is a clear risk that they will be used by accident, that they will be used by a madman, that they will be used by miscalculation. As I mentioned earlier, there's been many cases where, by the logic of nuclear deterrence, nuclear weapons should have been used, given that the command and control structures convinced themselves that they were under attack due to a variety of different reasons. So it's really difficult to say with any degree of certainty that they won't be used. And this is a bit this out of office syndrome. I mean, most foreign ministers, once they're out of office, they're like, yeah, nuclear weapons, awful stuff. We really have to make sure that they get that we get rid of them. But while they are in office, they act in the logic of the framework that they find themselves in, with which within NATO is extended deterrence, or for the United States, of course, is that as a great power, they need to have nuclear weapons. So it's really just the day that they leave office, former presidents in the US, former defense and foreign ministers, then start realizing, yeah, no, actually, if you're not in full control of the situation, you'd rather not have nuclear weapons. And I didn't focus this talk much on NATO or the situation in Western countries, given that I wanted to give a bit of a broader perspective. But the first step, surely, is to make sure that the countries that are not nuclear-armed states, but that are currently protected by the extended nuclear umbrella, should just get rid of that nuclear umbrella, given that it costs them nothing. They can do that, you know, at the stroke of a pen. And it doesn't change the security situation, but it removes this added layer of legitimacy to nuclear weapons, given that the United States won't be able anymore to claim that they need all these many weapons in order to keep also all of their allies safe, right? And so that's the first step. And, you know, if you talk to politicians, if you talk to ministers in Western governments, they always make you feel like this is completely out of the question, impossible, really stuff of lunatics and science fiction. But the fact is that three former secretary generals of NATO and more than 50 former prime ministers, former foreign ministers, and former defense ministers of NATO countries have all signed a letter together with ICAN urging all NATO states to join the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons as fast as possible, just a few years ago. So, I mean, if this number of former prime ministers, defense ministers, and even NATO secretary generals are willing to say, look, you should ditch NATO extended deterrence doctrine and enable NATO member countries to join the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which means that they would have to remove all nuclear weapons and they would have to stop participating in nuclear exercises with NATO and so on, it would have a number of practical consequences. So this is obviously the next step to do. This is the right thing to do. And this is something that I think we are well on track on to do within the next 5 to 10 years within NATO. I think this got delayed somewhat by the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. As I mentioned earlier, I think this has really introduced a number of competing perspectives into the whole security debate within Europe and has certainly made it more difficult to advance on this particular front. But nevertheless, I mean, I think the path is clear. And nobody can make an argument that it would have, that the war in Ukraine would have much gone differently if we had more nuclear weapons in Europe or you name it. So certainly conventional weapons are back en vogue. There's much more investment going into defense contractors and into defense equipment in Europe. But apart from, you know, this very fringe debate, there's nobody seriously suggesting that we should have nuclear weapons in Europe or that this would change anything for the better for our national security. But, of course, it impacts the way that some domestic political forces talk about nuclear weapons. So to make an example, in Germany, the Liberal Party was actually a fierce advocate of nuclear disarmament when they were last in power in the coalition government with the CDU. Under then Foreign Minister Westerwelle, they made a genuine, serious attempt to make sure that the nuclear weapons are removed from the German territory. It failed. But now, the current FDP party, you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody who will sign up to the ICAN parliamentary pledge committing them to work towards the ratification of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons by Germany. It's a complete wipeout of that kind of thinking in this particular party, and they are now much more hawkish and just much more right-wing than they were previously on this particular topic. And certainly also in other centrist parties, this has, I think, made it more difficult to get a majority for that. So I see two more questions. Maybe we still have time for that.
I also have like a question. The question is like, do you think the invasion in Ukraine would have been able to be prevented if they would have not given away their nuclear weapons? Because like, I think it's a little bit contradicting that on the one hand side, we say, okay, for smaller countries like North Korea, it makes sense to keep their nuclear weapons. But at the same time, we say, yeah, it does not make any sense for France or Great Britain to give away their nuclear weapons, especially like considering like Ukraine.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is something I actually raised earlier in the talk. I suppose you came a little later, but indeed Ukraine had weapons on their territory, but they didn't have control over them, so certainly keeping them wouldn't have changed anything. But even if they had control over them, I do question what is the point at which you actually go and nuke Moscow. So it's just not very credible in the process of the way that Crimea was annexed and then later on the full-on invasion. It's just not very credible that you'd go and kill millions of civilians in order to react to that invasion. It's also not terribly likely to lead to Ukraine winning the war, because the war is fought on the Ukrainian battlefield, and nuking Russia, yeah, sure, it could have made Putin think, oh, I should maybe stop invading Ukraine. It depends on the logic on nuclear deterrence, and it depends on how the actors react. But it could also have the opposite effect, that they just wipe out Ukraine altogether. The question, of course, yours is a different counterfactual. Supposing that Russia might never have invaded in the first place if Ukraine had nuclear weapons. And look, I don't want to come across as if I said that it makes sense for small countries to have nuclear weapons. I'm just saying that within the logic of nuclear deterrence, if you accept the logic of nuclear deterrence, then the inescapable conclusion is that as a small country, this is a cheap way to make yourself immune, right? Now, at no point should you accept the logic of nuclear deterrence, given that all of the heroic assumptions it rests on, like rational leaders. I mean, I'm not rational at the best of times, but if I know that I have 10 to 15 minutes to make a decision before the world explodes in nuclear war, it's not exactly conducive to rational decision making. Perfect information is another assumption of nuclear deterrence. You have to have perfect information about what's going on, perfect information about your command and control structures. All of this is completely unheard of in the time space of 15 minutes in such complex situations of like huge militaries and air forces and command and control and so on. So that's just not very credible. And then the entire idea that, you know, if you that you're going to go and kill millions of civilians and risk nuclear escalation, honestly, it's very difficult to convince your counterpart that you are so batshit crazy that you're willing to do that.
Einmal bitte das Mikro benutzen.
Yeah, but I have a feeling like it does actually work. Like you can see it with North Korea. Like the US would never invade like North Korea because they do have nuclear weapons.
But the US didn't invade North Korea when they didn't have nuclear weapons. So, you know, it's a bit difficult to argue with these very limited number of counterfactuals.
Okay.
Again, nuclear deterrence has failed a number of times, and I say if you're going to make the survival of humanity depend on it, then it better be perfect. And the final question here.
Yeah, thanks for your optimism. I'm not so optimistic, to be honest, but it's great to hear that. I have a very technical question. I know this 50 nuclear weapons scenario between India and Pakistan, but like, we had a lot of nuclear testing also going on. Shouldn't have we seen the same effect? Do you know any studies on that? I'd be interested.
Yeah, so I mean, not so much studies, but I can just explain why it's different. So a nuclear test, you're going to do that. If it's an atmospheric test, you're not going to do it over a city. You're going to do it over a desert. You're going to do it in the sea. You're going to do it within a mountain. You're going to do it in a place where nothing will catch fire. There will be no rubble, no buildings destroyed. So it's just not going to be all these trillions of particles that will go up into the atmosphere, right? So just the entire design of the test is not conducive to messing up the atmosphere for the entire planet. That said, we had more than 2,000 nuclear tests over the course of the 20th century, and the number is so breathtakingly high that basically radiation levels were noticeably higher across the planet, everywhere. You could measure radiation everywhere, no matter whether it was close or far from a test site. And this was, you know, so obvious that even the nuclear armed states were like, yeah, oopsie-daisy, maybe let's not test in the atmosphere anymore. Let's just test underground, shall we? And that's what they did. So yeah, indeed, there was a bit too much testing. We irradiated ourselves a little bit there, and then they stopped testing in the atmosphere. But no smoke and soot in the stratosphere, and therefore no nuclear winter associated with that. One final word, given that this is also wrapping up the talk, on the topic of optimism. I think that's really the biggest poison in many political debates, and certainly in nuclear disarmament, is to kind of give up and throw up your hands in the air when something seems impossible to achieve or certainly difficult to achieve. But that, the fact that it might be impossible, is no reason not to at least get as close as possible to a given goal, right? So we're not going to eradicate hunger or poverty, but how about we eradicate 90% of it? And the same with nuclear weapons. Okay, maybe the nuclear armed states are not exactly lining up to, you know, sign up for nuclear disarmament, but surely we can shame them into drastically reducing the number of scenarios in which they foresee using nuclear weapons. Surely we can get them to separate nuclear weapons for their delivery from their delivery vehicles, such as missiles, submarines, and strategic bombers. Certainly we can get them to further reduce the overall number of nuclear weapons, which is going to reduce the likelihood that anything goes wrong with them. So, you know, any step that we get closer to nuclear zero is, of course, already a safer world. And therefore, I think with this treaty and also with the entire work that is going into making sure that this treaty is more broadly known, is well known certainly by politicians, by policy makers, and by journalists and so on, is going to drastically change the perception of nuclear weapons, drastically change the perception of the utility of putting public funds towards such weapons, and every step along the way is, of course, going to make the world a safer place.
Thank you.